You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 150. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today we talk to Dr. Ted Banning about sampling strategies in archaeology and how we can make them better. Let's get to it. All right. Welcome to the show, everyone. And welcome, Paul. How you doing?
I think I'm doing okay. I had a little bit of tech trouble getting in here, and that's pretty much par for the course right now. As we're going hybrid at school, we found something very interesting, which is that our firewall, we beefed up our internet connection to the school, and our firewall, though it can handle it in terms of the traffic, just the raw bandwidth, it can't handle hundreds and hundreds of Zoom calls concurrently. And so we've been fighting with these spikes that just bring the whole network to a screeching halt, and trying to find new ways of routing. It's been a headache. So the troubles I had, 15 minutes ago to get on this call, par for the course for today. How have you been?
I'm doing great. Yeah. As everybody knows, we're traveling around the country. We are currently in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm sweating from humidity right now because we turn off the air conditioners when we record. So that's a stark contrast to the rest of the country. If you're listening to this in real time, we're recording on February 25th. So this comes out a bit later than that, sometime in March. But it's crazy. And we're surrounded by huge lizards, geckos or something, whatever they're called. Some from, a foot long to 4 feet long. They're crazy. They're all over the trees. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I do want to call out real quick, too, before we introduce our guest. If you're listening to the podcast of this, which you probably are, we are, of course, still an audio podcast, but our platform that we usually record on now has a pretty dedicated video component. So if you're interested in watching us, you can check the show notes and click over to the link to our YouTube channel where you'll have a video. There's nothing flashy over there. You're not going to see movies or anything. It's just us talking. So if you're interested in that, that's where we're going to be.
And our smiling mugs.
I know, right? I would say the YouTube channel link out loud, but I actually don't know what it is. It's probably /archpodnet, but who knows? It'll be in the links. So no worries. We'll send you straight to the video. And to be honest, we probably will even just link it in the show notes here. So you wouldn't see that on your podcasting device if you're on mobile, but if you click in and go to the page, then you'll see it right there on the show. So, but let's get straight to our guest today. And our guest today is Dr. Edward Banning, and he wrote an article called Sampled to Death, The Rise and Fall of Probability Sampling in Archaeology that came out in the latest edition of American Antiquity here in 2021. I'm not sure I even want to talk to him, but I'm probably going to find out that the thousands and thousands of shovel tests I dug were totally useless. So, Ted, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Paul. It's nice to be here.
All right.
We're glad to have you.
Yeah, absolutely. So what led to the writing of this article?
Well, it's kind of a funny thing because I hadn't really planned on writing an article like this, but I was asked to write a different paper for an edited volume on archaeological spatial analysis, a volume edited by Mark Gillings, Piraya Guzeler, and Gary Locke. And they asked me to write a chapter on spatial sampling. And they had very strict guidelines about what they wanted the articles to include. And among those things, they wanted me to include a section on best practices using real examples from the literature. And I thought, yeah, fine, that seems like it should be easy enough to do. And then when I went to the literature and tried to find best practices, I had a really hard time trying to find any. And it suddenly dawned on me that modern archaeologists either don't use sampling very much or just don't talk, or if they do use sampling or probability sampling, they don't really talk about it. They don't say how they did it, what kind of sample it was. And it started to really kind of concern me that this was an aspect of archaeological practice that seemed to be quite problematic. So I decided to write this article about it to see if I could kind of begin a discussion on where we need to improve our practice when it comes to sampling. And I should make it clear that I'm not arguing that people should always be using probability sampling, but there are some kinds of archaeological research where probability sampling really is called for. And I didn't really see signs that people were doing that, or at least they weren't talking about what they were doing.
Well, let's get our terminology down straight away here. When you say sampling, we're not necessarily talking about taking soil samples or something like that. We're talking about sampling and digging in different places, right? So why don't you define those terms for us to help focus this conversation?
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the other problems I saw in the literature. I ended up doing quite a big literature review when I wrote that article. And mm-hmm. one of the things I noticed is the word sample, we use it in lots of different ways. And in some ways, that's kind of understandable. But I think it also leads to quite a bit of confusion. So, you know, so we talk about radiocarbon samples and soil samples and, you know, botanical samples of various kinds or archaeometric samples. Mm-hmm. And when we use the term in those contexts, we're usually not talking about sampling in the statistical sense at all. And what I was right. mm-hmm. focusing on mainly in that article was the more statistical aspects of sampling. What sampling means in the statistical context is looking at a subset of some bigger thing that they call, a statistician calls a population, in order to make inferences about that population without having to examine the whole population. So, for example, you might want to know what's the proportion of red-painted pottery at site X, and you're not going to excavate the entirety of site X to figure that out. You're going to do a small excavation at site X, and right. that's going to give you a sample that you will use to make inferences about what's going on at site X. So that would be an example of sampling, but it wouldn't necessarily be a probability sample. So a probability sample is a mm-hmm. special case of a sample where you use statistical theory to try to ensure as best you can that the sample you take is representative of the whole population so that it can, you know, the characteristics of your sample are going to be similar enough to the characteristics of the population that you can make reasonable inferences about that population.
Right. I thought it was very interesting the way that you were distinguishing the way that people use sample. I immediately, after reading your article, went to my dissertation and typed in, you know, SAMPL to find how many times I used the wording, because I didn't do any kind of statistical sampling in my dissertation. It was some field reconnaissance. But you make the distinction, as you're just saying, between sampling as a rigorous, statistically validatable, I guess, way of collecting data, of ensuring that it's representative of a larger population. But we also, in the field, we use sample a lot. I took a sample of the soil. We took a sample of this, of the carbon. I used sample in my own example, my dissertation. I said, this sample of whatever, and it wasn't sampling in any sense like what you're using it as. It would have probably been better served by the word example.
Exactly. In many of those cases, I think it's better to use words like example or specimen. Mm-hmm. Or in chemistry, they would actually use words like aliquot. If you take, like in archaeometry, for example, sometimes you'll drill a little hole in an artifact and take out some materials for X-ray fluorescence analysis or neutron activation analysis, whatever. Mm-hmm. A chemist would call that an aliquot, whereas we always call it a sample. And right. sometimes it can be a sample in statistical right. sense, where you might randomly pick where the places where you're going to take it from or whatever. But most of the time, it has nothing to do with probability theory at all when we take these so-called samples in archaeology. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. And in fact, you know, let's be serious. I've used the word sample in these ways myself. You know, I'm being a bit hypocritical here. I'm sure if I went back to my dissertation, I would see lots of cases where I use the term sample in these kind of sloppy ways. But the point is, it creates a certain amount of confusion. And I think it might be a good idea yes. for us to use terms like sample a little bit more precisely. But I think the more important issue is not so much the terminological one, although that has some importance. But I think the more important issue is describing our samples more adequately. Like sometimes people in an article even say, we did a random sample of X, Y, and Z, but they don't tell you exactly what they did. You know, how did they do it? Was it a spatial sample? Was it a cluster mm-hmm. sample? They don't tell you what the sample size was necessarily. And I think it is not unreasonable to expect people in their methods section of their paper to say exactly what they did. You know, I used some kind of website that generates random numbers to pick random X and Y coordinates on the site and randomly selected 15 2-meter by 2-meter areas or whatever, which constituted a cluster sample. And then I did such and such kind of analysis. And generally speaking, I found mm-hmm. when I reviewed all these articles in several major journals that people were not doing that. A few did, but shockingly few. In fact, most of the articles that referred to using a sample appear likely to have been using what a statistician would call a convenience sample. And a convenience sample is just whatever I've got, essentially, you know, whatever comes to hand. You don't need to have any kind of statistical methodology in order to come up with a convenience sample. You just take the first, you know, 50 artifacts that you get can get your hands on or whatever. And that isn't necessarily a bad sample, but there's certainly a lot of risks that you'll end up with poor characterization of the population if you use convenient samples without thinking about it pretty carefully. For some purposes, a convenient sample can be fine, and for other purposes, it can be quite disastrous. You know, so for example, some convenient samples will be based on a small excavation in a site where somebody arbitrarily picks some spot on a site to excavate, and depending on where they excavate on the site, they might end up in the middle of a flint knapping area, in which case all of their inferences are going to be about, you know, wow, how much flint knapping was going on at the site. Or if they excavated somewhere else, it could be all about butchering or something like that, and hardly any evidence for flint knapping. So if you're unlucky, a convenience sample can give you a very poor idea of what's going on in the population.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I would imagine too that with a lot of CRM projects, which is what the bulk of my experience is with in the last decade or a little more, that it's really difficult to come up with an accurate probability sample, right? Because you mentioned a probability sample would have the, or sampling strategy would have the characteristics of the site at large, right? But a lot of times we don't know what the site at large looks like. And we're going off the heavy hits for shovel tests or pedestrian reconnaissance survey or whatever the case may be. And we're saying, hey, there was a ton of stuff over there. Let's drop a test unit in because we found a whole bunch of stuff when we were doing the shovel test bits. And that's often what determines where we dig and why we dig. Right or wrong.
that is true. And CRM archaeology does have its own challenges, many of which have to do with the fact that you don't get to decide as the CRM archaeologist, or at least you quite often don't get to decide what the parameters of your project will be. Some developer says, I'm going to be building a shopping mall or whatever, and you have to do the archaeology in this part of the map where I'm going to build a shopping mall. And it might not make a whole lot of sense in terms of an archaeological population that you want to sample, and you're kind of stuck with it. At the same time, one of the things I found when I did the literature review was it was a bit ironic that to some degree, CRM archaeologists have preserved the idea of doing probability sampling better than research archaeologists have done. You know, I'm overgeneralizing, but I found more instances where people would do something like a stratified random sample in CRM reports than I did in research articles, which I thought was kind of interesting, even though, you know, arguably that kind of approach wouldn't necessarily be a good approach in CRM, because it's at least certain kinds of CRM, your goal is to find as many significant sites as possible or something like that, not to make generalizations about a population necessarily. Having said that, it was still true that a lot of CRM reports did use some kind of probability sampling to the extent that they could. Whereas I wasn't finding that very much in the research publications of the last 20 years.
I could see that being some sort of an academic rationalization over around a way to save money, basically, rather than doing a lot more stuff. You're using fancy probability sampling to basically dig less and justify it with the science. I'm not saying that's necessarily true, but that could be one factor in it.
I think in some instances that could be a factor. But incidentally, something you mentioned when we were talking a minute ago, you talked about how sometimes you'll want to excavate someplace because there was more artifacts found there, or you had shovel tests, some positive shovel tests or something. So that's where you want to focus your further analysis. And what a lot of people don't realize, there's actually a type of sampling that's designed for that situation. It's called adaptive sampling. It's relatively new. It's only been around for about 25 years. And it is the type of sampling to do if you have something like shovel tests and you want to sample more intensively wherever you have a positive shovel test. So there is actually a formal way to do that. And some jurisdictions I found, like some of the CRM guidelines for certain states and provinces, actually recommend a type of adaptive sampling, although they don't usually call it that. But what they don't mention, and most archaeologists don't realize, is that if you use adaptive sampling, you have to use different statistics to analyze the data that come from that, because what you're doing is adaptive sampling builds in a bias because you're basically excavating where there's higher densities of artifacts So obviously, if you use that to estimate average artifact density, it's going to be wrong. It's going to be biased, right? Upwards, right? So you have to have use the right formulas for calculating things like mean and standard deviation and standard error when you're using adaptive sampling. It's not hard to do that. There's a very good book by Clive Orton that was published in 2000 called Sampling in Archaeology. And he has an appendix at the back where he has all these formulas for this is the formula you should use in such and such a situation. And one of those sections of that appendix is on adaptive sampling. So he tells you exactly what formulas you should be using if you use adaptive sampling. So in CRM, that would be a very good thing to be using sometimes, but you need to use the right formulas.
Right. That makes sense. I have a question, actually. You talk in your article about spatial versus non-spatial sampling. And it seems to me that it basically cuts across between things like field archaeologists on the one hand, including survey, doing spatial sampling, and specialists, faunal analysts, for example, doing non-spatial sampling. But ultimately, with archaeological data, almost everything comes back to a spatial component, right? So those potsherds that you're analyzing came from a particular locus in a particular trench on a particular site. So it has a spatial component. Is that distinction between spatial and non-spatial really meaningful in our field, or is that
It is meaningful, but you are correct that almost all the samples that archaeologists deal with at the end of the day are spatial samples. Like generally speaking, the only time, again, I'm overgeneralizing, but almost the only time that we use non-spatial samples in archaeology is when we're sampling stuff that's already been excavated. So it's sitting on the shelves of a museum or something. And there might be some site that was excavated in the 1930s and they excavated huge amounts of material. So there's hundreds of thousands of artifacts and we don't have time to analyze all of them. So we might randomly sample what is sitting on the museum shelves, for example. But most of the time, even the paleoethnobotanists and the faunal analysts and whatnot, are whether they recognize it or not, they're actually dealing with spatial samples. In fact, they're dealing with a special kind of spatial sample that's called a cluster sample. And that's another thing that was, it's kind of one of my pet peeves, really. And it's one of the things that came out in that article I wrote is that a lot of archaeologists basically ignore the fact that they're dealing with cluster samples. Because again, first I should explain what a cluster sample is. I mentioned the concept of a population. So a sample is a subset of a population. And most of the time, the population we're interested in is something like the population of artifacts or the population of plant remains or the population of animal bones or something like that. But we don't actually excavate the population of animal bones or plant remains or potsherds or lithics. Instead, we excavate and survey, whether we're doing excavation or survey, we tend to excavate or survey spatial areas, right? So we might have 2 meter by 2 meter squares that we excavate or transect strips that are, 5 meters wide and 100 meters long that we survey or something like that. And those are actually the elements in our population. So our population is not artifacts or plant remains. It's a population of spaces. Within those spaces, there may be artifacts, like potsherds and lithics, or there could be seeds or animal bones or human bones or something else. So we end up with kind of two kinds of population. The population we actually sampled is the spatial one. And the population we're really interested in is the non-spatial one. Whenever that happens, and it happens a lot in archaeology, we are almost always doing cluster sampling. So if we want to do something like estimate the mean length of projectile points from such and such a site that came from a cluster sample, to do that in an unbiased way, and especially to come up with accurate measures of standard deviation and standard error, especially standard error, again, you have to use the right formula for that. And most of the time, archaeologists ignore that they use a cluster sample, and they just use the standard simple equation for a basic simple random sample, which this is not, and you end up with an incorrect measure of standard error on your estimates. So cluster sampling is pretty ubiquitous in archaeology, and I think we need to make more recognition of that, and we should be teaching our students how to calculate means and proportions and standard errors on cluster samples. It's not hard, but unfortunately, most of the standard software that we use doesn't do it automatically. We have to, if you want to do it in an Excel spreadsheet or something, you have to kind of trick it to do it.
talking about math is a great place to take a break with a bunch of archaeologists. So let's do that, and then we'll come back on the other side and talk about I like some of these sections you've got in here called like the rise of archaeological probability sampling and then the fall of probability sampling. So let's talk about some of those concepts and some of the rest of the stuff from the paper on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 150. And just to remind you guys, if you want to see the video portion of this, where you get to see all my mistakes because I'm not editing it, the audio podcast does not hear this, but check out our show notes and our YouTube channel for the Archaeology Podcast Network. But in the meantime, we're going to go back to Dr. Ted Banning here, and we're going to talk about some other things in the article that you wrote. And again, the article is linked in the show notes, and it's open. No, it's not open. It's American Antiquity. That's right.
So, no, it actually is.
No, it is open. Actually
open. It's open.
Did they
access.
Open it? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Wonderful.
I always think of American Antiquity as not open, but Cambridge University Press has been doing some things and opening some of them. So we'll definitely link to that in the show notes if you want to follow along, because there's going to be a lot of stuff that we don't have time to talk about. We've talked about probability sampling, and there's a whole section, like a page and a half, where you talk about the rise of probability sampling, which we've kind of talked about what that is, but then you go right into the fall of probability sampling. So explain that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I was curious to see if I could figure out why it was that probability sampling, after being extremely popular during the 1970s, I know people like Lewis Binford really promoted it and it really took off. And mm-hmm. And for a while in the 1970s, and even to some extent in the early 80s, you know, there was an idea among archaeologists that no archaeological no serious archaeological research could take place without probability sampling, which was actually kind of a silly idea, but because there's lots of kinds of archaeological research that does not require probability sampling. But anyway, it became kind of the sine qua non of archaeology in the 70s. And then in the 80s, it suddenly dropped off. And I was curious as to why this might be the case. And especially after 1990, it dropped off. And I demonstrated this by simply counting the numbers of articles that talk about sampling in some of the major journals over several decades. I explored several possibilities for this. One was a blistering critique by a statistician named Bonnie Hole. She published an article in 1980 that criticized the way archaeologists had been doing probability sampling. But she didn't actually criticize probability sampling itself. She was really criticizing really bad examples of archaeological sampling, which is a different matter entirely. So, I don't think that had any impact on the drop-off of sampling. What I think is more important is the post-processual critique by people like Ian Hodder and especially Shanks and Tilley. Mm-hmm. And then also there was a very influential book that was published in 1990 called The Archaeology of Regions, The Case for Full Coverage Survey. So even though it was only addressing the issue of regional survey in archaeology, not sampling in general, it really, I think, went a long way to convincing people that sampling was not just a waste of time, but actually kind of evil, and that people shouldn't be doing it, and they should be doing this stuff called full coverage survey. Ironically, though, full coverage survey is really a kind of sampling, because nobody who does full coverage survey is actually finding 100% of the archaeological sites. You know, if they're really lucky, they might find 80 or 90% of the really big sites. They're only finding, in many cases, quite a small sample of the small, unobtrusive sites. But nonetheless, I think it had a big impact on people's thinking about sampling. So by the late 1990s, pretty much nobody thought that sampling was a good idea, at least in the case of regional survey. And nobody really talked about it much in other aspects of archaeology either, with the exception of some papers that focused on just having an adequate sample size for an archaeobotanical report or something like that. Yeah, it really collapsed quite rapidly in the 1990s.
I was wondering, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but get the sense, and you didn't say this explicitly, but it felt like it was an undercurrent of the collapse of statistical sampling in archaeology, was that especially post-1990, it's kind of an innumeracy among archaeologists. Do you think that that's an accurate characterization?
Well, that's a good point, because as somebody who teaches archaeology students a lot, including one of the courses I teach is a lab course where I expect students to do at least certain kinds of statistical stuff, including sampling. One of their labs that they have to do is a sampling lab. And it is a problem that not all, but most of the students who go into archaeology do not have much of a math background. And, you know, we can all agree that mm-hmm. math isn't, unless you're a mathematician, math isn't necessarily very exciting stuff. But sometimes there's a serious problem with enumeracy that archaeology students don't necessarily know how to do even really basic mathematical functions. So when we expect them to do something like calculate standard errors on a cluster sample, they find it really difficult. So I have to walk them through that process very slowly to try to get them to learn how to do that. And I hope that they take that away with them at the end of the course, but you know, who knows? Some archaeology students might decide, wow, thank God I got that over with. Now I'll never have to think about it ever again. And they go off and do their archaeology without any formal sampling ever again. But I think this is a problem. And one of the things I did discuss in the article was that in addition to reviewing literature on archaeology, I also reviewed some highly ranked archaeology and anthropology programs, undergraduate programs, to see whether or not archaeology students were required to take statistics, for example. And it turns out that, you know, a significant number of them do require some statistics background, but nowhere near all do. I forget the exact number. It's in the article, but something like 33% of the programs I reviewed or something have at least some kind of statistics requirement, but it's not a very substantial statistics requirement. You know, nobody's requiring archaeology students to become very adept at any kind of mathematics. And I don't really expect that they would, but it would be nice if there was a little bit more nuanced training in the kind of statistics that archaeologists would find useful. In my experience, I think most of the time when archaeology students do get some statistics training, it's usually pretty pro forma and it's not really tailored to archaeological problems very well. You know, for example, I also reviewed textbooks on archaeology. And a significant number of them have at least a couple of pages on sampling, but all they do is talk about sampling in a spatial context, and all they do is tell the difference between random, systematic, stratified, and sometimes systematic, stratified, unaligned survey. And so they tell students what those things are, but they don't tell them when you should use this one instead of that one, or why would you use this one, or how do you actually apply it, or if it's a stratified sample, how do you decide what the strata should be? How do you evaluate whether the stratification was useful or not? Those kinds of issues we don't discuss with our students by and large. And I think that's a shame, because teaching them kind of cookbook recipes for how to do sampling without teaching them how to apply the samples in the real world is not really accomplishing anything.
Well, I think that's interesting, the cookbook application of mathematical solutions problems. This 1990 date is interesting to me because this is a tech podcast and Chris and I are both heavy computer users. And that's right about the time that computers ended up on everybody's desk. Do you think that some of this could be attributed to the ease then with which one could do statistical mathematics with something like Excel, or I guess 1990, probably Lotus 1-2-3, because of the computers? You think that black box aspect of it made, for lack of a better word, made people a little lazy about how they were thinking about their sampling and how they were thinking about their stats?
That's an interesting idea. I actually hadn't considered that when I wrote that article. I'm going to have to go back and think about that. But I think there are two things here, because on the one hand, I think you might be right that the availability of software has allowed people to do a lot of really bad statistics, frankly. You know, I know some archaeologists who will take a data set and they'll just dump it into some statistics program like SPSS or whatever, and they'll just run every statistic they can think of to see if anything comes out with a significant, you know, probability of less than 0.001 or something like that. And that's a really bad approach, because first of all, they're violating the assumptions of at least half of those tests when they gave the data. Secondly, by definition, any random set of data, if you just submit, you know, 20 random sets of data to some statistical analysis, one of the 20 is going to be significant at the 95% confidence interval, just by definition, right? Because that's why it's the 95% confidence interval. That means one time in 20, you're going to get a significant result just by chance. So to do that kind of approach is really not very good. Yeah. But on the other hand, what people haven't picked up on is the positive side of all of this software, because the computers have enabled us, if we learn how to do it properly, to get a lot more out of our data than we once would have done, including how to sample it properly. So for example, one of the sites I use a lot, there's a website called random.org. And whenever I want to get random numbers, mm-hmm. that's where I go. You know, in the old days, you'd use a random number table or something like that, which is, you know, kind of a pain in the butt. Mm-hmm. But random.org actually gives you genuine random numbers. They're not just pseudo random numbers or something like that. They actually use meteorological data mm-hmm. or something like that to generate the seeds for the random number generator mm-hmm. that they use. And so it does generate wow. any kinds of random numbers you want. So you can say, I want a random number between 5 and 65, or between 1 and 100, or whatever the case may be, and it'll do that for you. I find it very helpful. And that's just one example. You know, there's tons of statistical resources and websites and whatnot that will help you do things like sample design. But by and large, archaeologists don't use them. They use things like Excel a lot. And unfortunately, Excel, for all of the merits it does have, it also has some weaknesses, including the fact that, at least last time I checked, it doesn't accommodate things like cluster sampling. And since archaeologists use cluster samples so much, that's a bit unfortunate. So if I use an Excel spreadsheet for a cluster sample, I have to actually do some kind of scripting in order to make it calculate the standard errors correctly. If I just use the regular formulas in Excel, I'm going to get incorrect values for my standard errors, because it assumes that I have a simple random sample, which I don't have. I have a cluster sample that's very different.
You know, I'm thinking too, you were mentioning students and hoping that they take some of this away from from your classes and apply it in an academic or even a CRM sense. How do you combat, as a professor, passion and intuition in archaeology? Because you see a lot of people out there that are just like, man, I just feel like there's something over there. You know what I mean? And even there's a lot of people talking about it. In fact, I even recorded an episode on one of my other shows about the Netflix show The Dig, about the Sutton Hoo excavation over mm-hmm. in the UK. And it even starts with the archaeologist or the excavator saying, I think we should dig here because this, and this. And the landowner saying, I think we should dig here because I convened with spirits and I feel like there's something there. And it turns out she was right. That doesn't do us a lot of good, but turns out she was right. How do you fight that when, like you said, archaeologists, we don't do math, right? We don't really study that kind of stuff, but you're trying to tell them that, yeah, if you do this stuff right and you fill these models with the right kind of data, they're going to give you the right answers, and you have to trust these models. I mean, that's got to be a difficult sell to most people that are in an archaeology program.
Yeah, well, you're right that it's a difficult sell to convince archaeology students that math is important. One of the points I try to make with my students is that I'm not saying that things like intuition are of no value. And in fact, one kind of sampling that I actually haven't talked about in this podcast is purposive sampling. That's another kind of sampling. It's kind of in between convenience sampling and probability sampling. Purposive sampling is when you use your own judgment to decide how to sample things. And in some kinds of situations, that's actually the best kind of sample to use. I find it's very good choice in cases where you have a very specific hypothesis you want to test, for example. So, you know, you've got, I'm not sure if we're going to think of an example off the top of my head very quickly, but, you know, for example, if you are excavating a site and you find traces of a wall or a row of post holes or something, and you think you found part of a such and such kind of building, you perhaps get the idea that, well, if this is the kind of building I think it is, there should be another row of post holes around 4 or 5 meters to the east of here. Well, then the obvious thing to do is sample 4 or 5 meters to the east of here to see if you find more post holes, right? That just makes good sense. It's good common sense. A random sample of the space is not going to accomplish that for you anywhere near as efficiently. So purposive sampling is a great way to go in some kinds of circumstances. But the other thing is that if you're willing to go the direction of mathematical approaches, there are also Bayesian statistical approaches. And Bayesianists put a lot of emphasis on what they call prior information. So even your gut instincts can constitute prior information, and you actually build that into your mathematical model. But it's in a much more formal way than just saying, I think we should go dig over here. it actually allows you to do things like figure out what's the probability that I'll find such and such here rather than there and so on, using good sound mathematics, but it also accommodates people's professional judgment and intuition and all that kind of thing. Now, for example, just to use an example that's not archaeological, in marine search and rescue, they use Bayesian approaches to decide where to send the searchers to find a plane that went down in the Atlantic Ocean or whatever. And they use prior information on things like currents and wind direction and what was the location of the plane the last time that the pilot radioed in. And those all become parts of the prior information. Right. But they also use professional judgment. Like they might stick a bunch of admirals in a room and ask their opinion. Like, where do you, you know, each one of you bet on where you think the plane went down. And they use that information as part of their prior information for their model. And by doing this, they actually find downed ships and whatnot, ships and airplanes, a lot quicker most of the time. Now, admittedly, there have been some failures of that too. Famous one, Malaysian flight. I forget what the flight number was now, which they searched for months and never found it. You know, who knows why they weren't successful in that particular instance. But most of the time, they're actually quite successful. And archaeologists can use those kinds of methods as well, which go beyond just sampling. It's not necessarily sampling at all. But the mathematical approaches in archaeology do have a lot of potential that is mostly unrealized, partly because archaeologists don't tend to get much background in math.
The searching for a lost plane or ship is a good example, because that really rings true for me, because I'm a pilot and I'm also in the Civil Air Patrol in Reno, Nevada. And Nevada is vast expanses of basically nothing, right? And they do start with initial information. What was the last radio call, like you said? Were they caught on radar? Were they seen from the ground? Did anybody, you know, hear them? What's their flight path? Did they file a flight plan? Things like that. And once you search those grids and you don't find them, then we start talking to pilots and saying, if you were flying this route and if there was a storm coming or if you had an engine failure or something like that, what would you do? And they start bringing intuition when the logical stuff starts to not produce results. So that definitely pans out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In essence, Bayesian analysis allows you to incorporate professional judgment and even intuition into a mathematical model.
There you go. All right. Well, I think that's a good takeaway. But in just the last couple of minutes here of this podcast, or at least this section, what are some other takeaways you'd like people to take away from this article? And we'll link to it so people can read the whole thing. But what are some of your big takeaways regarding sampling?
I suppose one big takeaway is to make sure people realize that I'm not trying to argue that people should always be using probability sampling, because, you know, I myself, you know, I do a lot of archaeological survey in my own research, and I don't, most of the time I actually don't use probability sampling for that. I use some version of purposive sampling that is informed by a predictive model, for example. So nowadays we have GIS. You can use predictive modeling in order to inform your survey search, because I'm doing a kind of survey where I'm trying to search for particular kinds of sites. I'm not trying to find a random sample of sites or try to make generalizations about some population of, you know, whatever sites ever used to be in this region. I'm usually trying, in my own case, I'm usually trying to find Neolithic sites. And a random sample would be a really bad way to try to find those. So I'm not trying to say that probability sampling is the way you should always go. But I do think it's important for archaeologists to realize when probability sampling is useful and when it's not. And if you are going to use it, how to use it as effectively as possible. And a lot of the times that's going to mean making very informed choices about a stratified cluster sample is most of the time going to be the best solution for us. But it's going to vary depending on your situation and whether it's a CRM problem or a research academic research problem or whatever. Those can sometimes be the same kind of problem, and other times they can be quite different. So you have to customize your sample design to the situation.
I like that. While we wrap up this discussion today, I did want to ask you, though, you end the article with a series of proposals, varying degrees of detail, about how you could reintroduce probability sampling into the curriculum for student archaeologists. Do you actually have hope that that's going to happen?
You know, I do have some hope that it's going to happen. It's difficult, in part because even the people who instruct students today, you know, let's face it, most of them have not had a lot of training in things like probability sampling or statistics. Some have. Some have been trained on it way better than I have, but I think they're a minority. So I think it's a bit of an uphill battle. But I think the important takeaway in terms of student training, I think, is to get away from these kind of cookie cutter approaches where you just teach the students, this is a random sample, this is a stratified sample, this is a some other kind of sample. Yeah. And then they learn it for a week, they write their tests, and then they forget about it afterwards. I think it's much more useful to teach them things like, how do you decide which kind of sample to use in a particular situation? Or if you're going to use a stratified sample, how do you decide how to stratify it effectively? Because that, I think, is not being done as a general rule.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, just one final question for you, Dr. Banning. Is Sampled to Death in the article title an homage to Dug to Death, the book by Adrian Praetzelis?
No, actually it's not. Actually, it's not. I actually am aware of that book, but I hadn't thought of it when I was writing the title.
It's the first thing that popped into my mind when I saw that.
I was probably actually thinking about how many articles I had to read in several archaeological journals and compile my data for that one. And I actually ended up, because it was, I did read quite a few articles beyond what I sampled, but at the end of the day, I ended up doing a disproportionate stratified random cluster sample of the articles in several journals. And after I finished that process, I really felt that I was sampled to death.
Wonderful.
Nice. That sampling strategy sounds like me trying to order a coffee at Starbucks. It's just a mouthful. All right, sir. Well, thank you very much. This has been great. Everybody, check out the show notes and read this article. It's a really great article, whether you're an archaeologist or not, whether you're an academic or a CRM. There's some really good points in here to keep in mind. So definitely check this out. And like you said, it's American Antiquity, but it is open access. So go check it out before they close it down, because who knows when they're going to do that, if they do at all. I don't know if it'll be open access forever. But thank you for coming on. Everybody else, stick around. We are going to come back with a segment 3, and Paul and I are going to wrap up. And we're going to talk about my new virtual office that I'm using as I'm traveling in my RV around the country. So again, before we go, Dr. Banning, thanks for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
And thank you for inviting me, Paul and Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for being here. It's been great.
All right. So we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute with segment 3. Stay tuned. All right. Welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 150. And we just got done interviewing Dr. Ted Banning. But I got to say, because there might be some changes on this segment that you might notice, through the magic of podcasting and the internet, Paul and I didn't actually have a chance to record segment 3 right away. So we're recording it like a week and a half or two later. So if you notice some slight differences, then that's why. My background never changes because, well, I don't even know if I was outside or inside when we recorded this, but I'm in Georgia now and I was in Florida before. So there you go. And I think Paul lost some facial hair. So we're all good. Yeah. But Paul, I think some of my key takeaways for that were really around the, and I mentioned this in one of the segments too, the thousands and thousands of shovel tests I have dug on really basically indeterminate, like for no reason, state mandated grid systems. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it feels like a massive waste of time. And there are people doing that right now. Like every day, mm-hmm. people are out there digging on 30 meter intervals because that's what the state says you should dig at is 30 meter mm-hmm. intervals with, you know, basically little to no reason behind that.
Yeah. When I think of that, it reminds me of the fact that, like, you know, if you want your doctor's records, it goes in faxes because the laws that were drawn up about privacy were written for the technology of the time in the 80s, which is fax machines, right? And so now, you know, trying to get an email of your medical records is a total pain in the ass. Oops.
Yeah.
We're not going to get the explicit rating for that, are we? No. It's a total PETA. because you can't do it just through your regular email. You've got to do it through some weird emailing system that texts mm-hmm. you a link or something. Or you could just send it with fax if you still had a fax machine somewhere.
Right.
So that problem that you're talking about of dealing with these regulations, these guidelines of to how you have to sample are probably written, enshrined into law or into whatever regulations mm-hmm. a long time ago. And I thought that the discussion with Dr. Banning was really interesting because he was challenging us, you and me directly, us as a field, to really re-examine how we sample, what we think sampling actually is. You know, and I let off talking about how I had to go back and look at my dissertation to see how I used the word sample or sampling, which I've used very infrequently, but the few places I used it probably weren't really accurate. And so he gave us a bunch of different kinds of strategies about sampling. And I found it a really interesting discussion because I went afterwards and I was looking to see what stats for archaeologist books I've got in my bookshelf. I looked back and I realized I only had one stats class as a grad student. I mean, it was specifically for archaeologists, but it's nearly 30 years ago now. I don't remember anything from it. I definitely need to refresh my knowledge, and I suppose that a lot of people here probably do too. So, it was exciting to me to be challenged like that in a way that makes me want to dig in more. I don't know if you had a slightly different effect. Oh, no pun intended. Oh, geez.
Of the things you're not allowed to say at an archaeology podcast, dig in is at least in the top five. I'm just kidding. I think, I mean, coming from a CRM perspective, pretty much everywhere you go, there are regulations to what qualifies as a site, what qualifies as an isolate, what's your interval that you should be doing your pedestrian survey on, or what's your interval that you should be shovel testing on. And I don't think there's an inherent problem with having a methodology and a standard, because if you don't, people will just not do it, right? They'll just do whatever they want. I'm thinking of Florida. When I worked in Florida back in, I think it was 2007 or 8 or something like that, doing shovel tests down there, they were 50 by 50 centimeter square shovel tests as opposed to 30 centimeter round shovel tests that a lot of states have. But a lot of the East Coast states for some reason have, not, I wouldn't say a lot, but some have 50 by 50 centimeter square shovel tests. But there was a thing down here with low, medium, and high probability. And I think low was a 50 meter interval, medium was 30, and high was either 15 or 20 meter. And that was based largely on elevation, right? Because Florida has very few elevation changes. And when you're working down in, say, where we were near the Lake Okeechobee area, I mean, your mean elevation is somewhere around 3 to 5 feet above sea level. And if you've got even one little spot that's a little bit higher, it's a much higher probability area, theoretically, because that was high ground. It's high ground, you know, 1,000 years ago, and it's high ground now. Now, there are some problems with that because the ground out here is sand. I don't care where you're at in Florida, it's sand, right? It's sand pretty much everywhere. And one hurricane that comes and runs across the landscape could totally transform what the landscape looks like. So high ground now was certainly not high ground, even maybe even 100 years ago in a certain area, right? Depends on how close to the coast you are, but there are a lot of factors there. If you got a lot of well-developed vegetation on this high spot of ground, that can help hold it together and that can help keep it there. But my point is, the models, if there are any that are predicting this sort of strategy, if those aren't constantly fed information, they're not going to be accurate, right? We need to constantly feed models information in order for them to give us more accurate predictions. And the more information you feed it, you know, they're very hungry things. The more information you feed it, the more accurate what it's telling you is going to be. And that's it. But I just have a feeling that a lot of this stuff was done intuitively back in the day, and there weren't actually any models, or maybe there was a model to start out with, but it certainly hasn't been maintained, and it certainly hasn't been fed regularly and is completely malnourished. So there you go. I just, and that's what we're basing all of our field work on.
Right. Nice metaphor. I like it.
Yeah. So I appreciate the discussion we had with Dr. Banning, and I think that was really good and very timely as people start going into field work. For those of us that do field work on this show or that listen to the show, I think it's something to think about, right? Something to think about while you're getting ready to go do your strategies out there. So, all right, well, let's transition then. I have only one thing that I wanted to mention. We haven't really had an app of the day segment in a while, but I'll tell you what, I got something I got to mention that is really been transforming the way that I do work. And let me back up a minute and say, you know, as longtime listeners of this show know, I've been living in our in a 36-foot Class A motorhome since June of 2020. My wife and I put our house up for rent, so somebody's renting it now. And we moved into this motorhome just not because we had to, but because we wanted to. We love traveling around the country. And even in a pandemic, in fact, almost especially in a pandemic, because you can still stay socially isolated in your home, but your home can move. And I feel like it's kept our peace of mind a little bit better because we can be in different locations. situations, but still just be with each other and be, you know, safe and isolated like anybody would if they're going from their home. It's just our home has wheels. So, and an engine, that's important because a lot of people live in homes with wheels that don't go anywhere, but ours has an engine and can go lots of places. But one of the things I had to sacrifice, you know, for the first couple of months, I had my 27-inch iMac computer with my 27-inch Thunderbolt display sitting up on the dash of our RV over here. And when we were moving or underway, I laid them back on the bed, and it was just a kind of a real pain to set that up, tear it down, make sure I'm not going to smash them into the walls, make sure they don't, you know, fall off the dash. I mean, it was pretty secure up there, but also that big window got really hot sometimes and would just radiate heat onto my computers. And then I'd have to have the shades down, and then it was just get really hot up there. And it was just, you know, it was too much. And they're real huge power sinks too. And we were on like a 30 amp system versus a 50 amp at some parks. I would actually have power issues on those computers if the air conditioners kicked on while I had them on. Oh, yeah. They could shut off on me. So I ended up getting rid of them. And all I had was this laptop that I'm talking to you guys on. Well, I've been looking at displays again. And the one I was looking at was a 40-inch curved display because it was one display, but it was still a display. Mm-hmm. It would fit nicely in that spot up there, but I still had the same old problems of having to move that thing around and then heating issues and stuff like that. So I started looking around. And what I ended up with was the Oculus Quest 2. Now, if you are listening to the audio version of this podcast, I strongly recommend that you switch over to the YouTube version of this podcast because I'm showing it on screen here if you've never seen one. So this, for the video watchers, is the Oculus Quest 2. It comes with two controllers that look like this, although they've got really good hand tracking. So in a lot of cases, you don't even need the controllers. You can just minority report it and move things around and do stuff with your hands, which is kind of cool. But I didn't get this for any games. And there's a couple that I've downloaded just for fun, but I got this for an app that came out last summer called Immersed VR, and we'll leave a link to this in the show notes, but it's immersedvr.com. Again, they're brand new and they've had a lot of recent developments. They specifically coded, because they are so new, basically for the Oculus line of products. I think the Oculus and the Oculus Quest 2, the Oculus Quest and the Quest 2 are the ones they work with, and maybe even the Rift, but it's not displayed on their website anymore. But what they allow you to do is, and there's even a free version that works really well. I actually paid for it because I like five displays, and to get five displays and some other stuff, I needed this. But it basically links wirelessly with your computer on the same network and allows you to put a display of any size in front of you and many, many different resolutions. So if you want a really high resolution, that's great. If you want a lower one for, you know, lower latency, then you can do that. And then you can create up to five additional displays, and you can configure those right inside your computer, arranging them like you would any normal displays. And you can also drag them around visually in front of you, which mimics the display arrangement on the computer. You can use your hands as a mouse. You can use the controllers as a mouse. It's got keyboard mapping. So if I'm sitting here in front of my laptop, I map my keyboard to the virtual keyboard internally, because a lot of times it just helps being able to see your keyboard. You know, even if you're a good typist and you know where the F and J keys are because of the little raised, you know, lines on there, it helps being able to see your keyboard. So you can see your physical hands in the virtual environment, and you can see them go onto a physical keyboard or a virtual keyboard, which mimics your physical one. And I'll tell you what, it is just phenomenal working in that space, editing podcasts, editing video, working with clients where I need to have multiple windows open because I'm looking at the notes I'm taking about them, the notes that I have from the last meeting, their environment up on one screen, some other stuff up on another screen, and then the Zoom call on a completely different screen. And it's transformed my workspace. And this was, the monitors I was looking at were like $600-$700, and this was $400 because I got the, or maybe it was five because I did get the to 256 gigabyte version versus the 64 gigabyte to have more onboard storage. In retrospect, I don't think I needed it, but I wasn't sure because I never had one before.
I just looked at them online and hit their pricing and saw the two models. I said, oh, Chris got the higher one.
Well, it was such a massive difference in size of an amount of memory for not that much of an increase in price. And I'm like, I have no idea how much space these things need, right? Like, I literally have no concept of it. So I may as well get the bigger one because it's still cheaper than a monitor and it's great. So I just wanted to mention that. Again, we'll put the links in the show notes. But Paul, have you ever thought of VR or anything as a solution like this, or have much experience with VR?
I certainly don't have a whole lot of experience with VR. I have thought about something like this, but not seriously. I think it's just because I've seen representations of things like this. So it's interesting that you know, that this kind of snow crash world is catching up to us, or we're catching up to it, that you can actually go into these spaces. You already said, what was Minority Report, you know, you can go into these spaces and manipulate virtual representations of physical objects in and around you in order to actually accomplish a task that isn't playing a game, you know, or isn't just, you know, having some trippy kaleidoscope looking thing going, wow, this is really cool, but actually to do some work. That's pretty cool. Definitely on board with this being an interesting tech.
Well, in this app in particular, they really focus on collaboration really hard, because they've got a few. You can have your virtual environment be anything from a static image if you just want to, you know, cut down on your latency. Maybe you've got internet issues or something like that, so you can really kind of reduce that down and just focus on your screens. But if you've got the internet for it, you can be in like a spaceship, for example, sitting in the front of the spaceship and traveling over the planet Earth, that you can actually look around and you and see, you know, out the side and down. It's ridiculous, right? Sometimes I found myself just like staring out the window, for lack of a better way to say it. And it was just, it's just really neat. And then they have some public environments, like cafe type environments, where other people that come in there, you get seated basically randomly in there, and you see the person's avatar. You don't see their screens, but you see their virtual hands moving around that are field mapped using the Oculus sensors on the outside. And if your microphone's turned on, you guys can sit there and just have a chat, just like you were sitting in a coffee shop or something like that, or you were sitting somewhere random and you just strike up a conversation with a stranger. And then the level that I purchased, I think the elite level, which is like, I don't know, like $14 a month, gets me the features I want. But I also did that because I have a friend who just got a job at the place where I'm working. He's also into VR. He's been into PlayStation VR for a long time. And after a few weeks here, he just started this last week. So in a little bit here, hopefully he's going to pick up a Quest 2 and he's going to come in on my account in Immersed VR, and we'll be able to like legitimately collaborate in a VR space, a private room that we can set up and, you know, throw up a private whiteboard and, you know, draw out things, because we do that all the time when I'm working with clients, and I'm going to be one of the people training him in the software that we're implementing. And being able to collaborate in that kind of space is going to be transformative, I think. It's going to be really great.
Have you interacted with any other real person in this environment yet? Or will this be your first experiment with that?
Well, twice. I went into one of those public rooms a couple times, and you know, one time it was just people, just they had their heads down working. I don't even know why they were in the public room, and I never turned my microphone on either, so there's that. But I was just waiting to see if people were having conversations, and I didn't want to bug anybody if they weren't. Another time I went, it was a completely different experience. One guy came in and he unmuted immediately, because you can see that they're muted or not on their thing. He unmuted immediately and was like, hey, can you hear me? And I was like, yeah, I can hear you. Pretty cool. I'm just doing some work here. And he's like, this is a pretty cool app. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty cool. And then he shut off his microphone and we just basically both went to work. And then another woman popped in and you could hear her saying, I think people can hear us. And you heard somebody else in the background, is your microphone on? And then they figured out where they were and they were doing to shut that down pretty quickly. So, I mean, most of the time when I go in there, I'm really doing serious work. So I haven't gone into the public rooms that often. And really what I'm looking for is my colleague to pick up a Quest 2 and jump in here. And so we can do some real work. We'll probably be using it almost every single day to do that. That's the other thing, is it's not as uncomfortable as you might think. And I don't have the additional comfort strap that you can get with this that makes it a little more comfortable, but I have a longer cord, because this comes with a pretty short USB-C charging cord. I bought like the 16-foot long one, so I can basically sit essentially wherever I want. I don't have to be in front of my computer. And the second day I had this, I think I had it on for about probably 10 hours total that day. I mean, obviously I got up and took some breaks, but my working time was about 10 hours that day, and I had it on the entire time and I noticed zero fatigue on it. So
cool.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely see, I mean, since we've gotten more or less comfortable with this whole Zoom world now, I could definitely see how collaboration working with somebody would be improved by that. But you said you got it specifically to have more screen real estate. What do those screens look like? What do those virtual display monitors, they look like real monitors?
Yeah, they look like your computer screen. They don't have any edges on them. They're edge to edge, right? So they don't have some sort of, you know, skeuomorphic computer monitor looking design. But if you have just one, it's typically right in front of you and you can make it go forward, backward. You can enlarge it. You can change the resolution. So, you know, your content can be smaller or bigger within that screen, but you can also physically change the size of it. Like you're getting closer to it or around it. And then you can curve them as well. And you can have up to five, and you can have all five in random directions. You can even have vertical orientation on some of those. Often I'll have a vertical one that's off to the left that's got Slack and Teams and my Timular account because I don't need those as often. So they just kind of sit there on a high-res vertical monitor off to my left. And I mean, I physically have to look over to the left to see it too. And then if you... It's got five, three across and then two on top. It's got five kind of placeholders. If you drop your monitors into one of those placeholders, like if all five were in there, you could curve the entire thing and sort of wrap it around you in any sort of angle that you wanted, right? Whether it's I have to look all the way to the right to see the monitor or it's just slightly curved in front of me. So the thing I really like about it is it's good for your neck, right? Because when I first started using it, I had my monitors like up here, like they were up in the sky, right? But I realized, what am I doing? I can just sit here and be comfortable and have them down here and just like not where my computer screen would be, but lower than my computer screen because that's where I naturally want to just kind of sit when I'm looking at that stuff. So
right. Like you're reading a book or something.
Exactly. Exactly. Except it's all five computer displays.
to the computer displays. I mean, that sounds like you've laid out a virtual layout that's not unlike what I've got. I mean, I actually work between here in the country, apartment in the city, and three different buildings, depending where I'm at the school, depending which day of the week it is. I have some variant of the same layout. I've got over here, I've got my laptop and I've got, you know, right now it's got my messages and it's got Discord open right in front of me. I've got my my main monitor. So the laptop is an M1 MacBook Air. I can't remember the exact resolution off of it. This one here is a 1080p monitor. Not great resolution, but it's fine. 24 inches. That's got my browser on it. If I'm doing any writing, if I'm doing anything, it's happening directly in front of me. But then I also have via sidecar, I've got a iPad mini that sits just under that monitor. And so if I need to get something out of the way, I just drag it down to that monitor. So sometimes I'll have Zoom meetings up here so I can more or less make eye contact with people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll move the whole Zoom meeting down to the iPad. Anyhow, that's my setup. Yeah. It sounds like you reproduce something similar that works for you with these virtual things. But I would have to take a look at it because I would just be afraid that that the resolution in this virtual world wouldn't be as good as what I've got, even with the worst of the three here, which is this 1080p monitor.
You are possibly right. It really depends on your configuration and how you're using it. I have been trying to set stuff up like I'm at a drive-in movie theater because that's what it feels like, right? And it's really hard to take yourself out of that headspace and restructure these things so you get the right, because there's probably... There's three pages of resolutions you can choose from on each one of those monitors, and anything from like 3860 or whatever the heck that is, all the way down to, you know, like 600x400 or something. I mean, it's crazy. So you just got to find the right combination, and I think I'm still trying to dial it in. If all goes to plan, you'll be able to try this in about a month or so when I'm in your area. So there you go. Well, let's wrap this up. It's late. We got to get going. I'm glad we were able to wrap up this podcast. If you've got any thoughts on sampling strategies, VR, whatever the case may be, contact us. Contact information is on the website in the show notes at arcpodnet.com/archaeotech, any episode. But if you want to talk about this one, /150. If you want to become a member and support us, please check out arcpodnet.com/members. It's just $7.99 a month. You get a lot of little extras with more coming down the line always. And at the very least, you're supporting us and keeping this whole crazy train going. So it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, but we appreciate that support. We really do. It's so nice to have... know those people back us, and then also when they do come and interact with us online, on the Slack, wherever, it feels like we're doing something good.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, thanks everybody, and thanks Paul.
Thanks Chris. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeotech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.arcpodnet.com/archaeotech. contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugol.com. Support the show by becoming a member at arcpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off-Road and is licensed free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.